Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by Wiehau Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Dear listeners, a very warm welcome to a new edition of our WHU podcast, Leading Corporate Transformation, powered by PwC. My name is Martin Glaum. I'm a professor at WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management. And with me, as always in this podcast, is Gori von Hirschhausen from PwC. Gori.
Oh, thanks, Martin. Thanks, everyone. A big hello to our listeners from my side. My name is Gori von Hirschhausen, and I'm the co-host of this podcast. As you know, I'm the transformation consultant in this talk, and I do lead our industry sector consulting at PwC Germany. My background is to help our clients to optimize and to transform their finance function, so it is a very special honor for me to introduce you to our today's guest. Warm welcome to Emmanuel Thomasin.
Yeah, Thomasin or Thomasin, as you want.
Okay, perfect. From Delivery Hero.
That's correct. Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me today in the podcast. I'm very excited to be part of you.
Cool. Cool that you're here. Maybe, Emmanuel, can you give a short introduction to yourself and to the company Delivery Hero? Everybody knows them, but maybe a quick intro from somebody who is working on the top line of this company.
No, happy to. I mean, so my name is Emmanuel. I'm the CFO of the group for the last 10 years. French by nationality, but I've been growing up in Germany a lot. So I consider myself as a half German, half French. My way of working is very German. So I joined Delivery Hero like 10 years ago, and I'm acting as the CFO of the group. The company itself, I mean, like, you're, for the one that are German, is a translation of Lieferheld, which was the first company we funded actually in Germany, and was for the first platform. And literally, as we started to expand, we called it Delivery Hero. And at the beginning, you could say, well, it was not really like the name was a bit confusing because we were a marketplace business and not delivering at all. But today, it's not the case anymore. The company is headquartered here in Berlin. We are pretty proud of that. I mean, we think, we should promote European companies. We have a lot of talents in Europe. We can attract a lot of talent to Europe. And that's why we stayed here in Germany, although we don't have any business anymore, but probably have questions on that later. So yes, and the business today is delivering almost everything, starting from food very early days, which is like almost 13 years ago, to now delivering literally everything you want within 60 minutes. There are some limitations when you look at the volumes, but otherwise, I mean, literally everything that is deliverable in 60 minutes, this is what we do. And we do this in 70 countries in the world. So we're 24/7 on, actually.
What an interesting case. Gori already said that. To remind our listeners, this is the company, Delivery Hero, that became a member of the DAX family in 2020 in August, I think. At the time, I think you were valued around 40 billion euros. And it caused quite a bit of a stir at the time because for two reasons, one or related reasons maybe. One reason was you had never made a profit until this time, and if I may comment, still don't.
Correct.
And the other one was you were, as you already said, not doing business in Germany at all, right? But still became part of the DAX family. You remember that time?
And absolutely.
directly to the finance guy, did it really matter much to become member of the or part of the DAX? And did it matter much when 2 years later in 2022 you had to leave again?
Well, sure. I mean, like, you know, it's it was not unexpected. It was expected, but not in 2020. And I can give you a secret. Every year we are organized what we call the World Finance Meeting, a World Legal Meeting. So World Finance, World Legal Meeting, because the General Counsel is reporting to me. And in November 19, we're thinking about what should be the topics for next year. And there were two words, think DAX. So we were like having a summer meeting in 2020, thinking about what should we do in order to be ready for the DAX on top of what we were doing already. And you know, the story, basically one company of a German company, Wirecard, had to be excluded from the DAX and we replaced them. So if you ask me, it came basically not as a surprise, but earlier than we expected. At that time, the rules were different, as you know. I mean, like, it was not an obligation to make profit. So We didn't follow the rules. The rules were applied in Germany, and yes, that's, we were not very welcome in the club, to be quite frank. It's something that I learned actually in Germany. This is a very private club, and you don't feel really welcome. And the support from the politicians, let's say, or also from the economy, was modest, I would say. So yeah, and then 2 years after, we had to leave. The valuation, the market turned dramatically. That was a very good learning actually for the entire organization. I must say, like, you know, like the IPO, like the DAX, one thing that we keep on in mind is that this is just an event. So you have to fulfill certain obligations, and you have to make sure that, you know, you have certain processes in place. We'll talk about this probably later on. But it was just an event in the story of the company, like the IPO. So you have to do the job every day. And I think this is what keep us basically, like, you know, busy until we left the DAX.
So it was an episode, as you said, and a very interesting one. Maybe we go back to the very basics, because, you know, people know your name. People may, however, not fully understand the business model you're actually pursuing. So let's dive a little bit deeper into this. My understanding is the way it works is you're basically a platform that connects customers with restaurants or groceries or other shops, and you are the logistics part in between, delivering the stuff to the people. Is that basically correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So we were a marketplace before, so just listing on one hand the vendors, what we call the vendors now, but they were restaurants only at the beginning, and connecting to the consumers, replacing the leaflets on the fridge.
Mm. Can you give us a few key numbers to describe the business, you know, size or dynamics of it?
Yeah, sure. If you look today, as I mentioned before, 70 countries, we do around 260 to 270 million orders per month. We have 1 million riders active per month. We have 3 million riders that are listed, so we can ask 3 million riders to work for us. We deliver in average below 30 minutes. And we are a business that is really depending on the density of population, on the density of restaurants. Last year, we've done almost 45 billion GMV. So this is their external Umsatz, or as you would call it. And then, well, we were growing extremely fast. Last year, we've done 10.5 billion euro revenues for a company that was like making 40 million revenues in 2013.
An enormous growth story. That's true. The GMV, I found that funny. When I look into your annual report, it's there. You don't even explain it. It's there from the first page, and you just assume that people know what it is. It's cross merchandise value, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this is including VAT and that kind of
revenue. So, you know, your industry, you and the other players in the industry were programmed, hard coded into growth.
That's correct.
Massive growth year on year, doubling the size, you know, for several years. And the promise was, you know, this is a business that needs scale. Mm-hmm. And once we reach scale, we will be profitable, because it's a huge market out there, huge potential, and just give us the money to grow and then we will be profitable.
That's great.
But you are not profitable after, you know, you've been around now for more than 10 years and enormous growth and still not. So is the story wrong, or what's going on?
Well, I have to correct you. I mean, we are highly profitable in a lot of markets, and you will be astonished. I can't tell the name here, but like some small European markets have been profitable since 2015 and paying dividends to the company. And there are markets where basically we are highly profitable, 4% of GMV, which is quite a massive profitability, and still growing by 30%. So we are not profitable at the group level. And you can dig into the reasons, but we're building a second business. You mentioned before the Dmarts or the dark stores, and this is a completely new business, and we're investing quite a lot of money. This part of the business will become EBITDA, just EBITDA profitable at the end of the year, and then continue on this trajectory. So we continue to invest, actually. And if you look at this industry of the quick commerce or the Dmarts, many players have disappeared very quickly. It's not an easy one, but we think that we have something here that will be extremely big in the future, but require investments. And this cycle of investments, you can tell is short or long. I mean, we started the Dmart business in 2019, but require capital at the beginning.
So looking at the markets which are very profitable, as you say, what are your most important markets, and do you consider to further consolidate the business around these markets? And what's the outlook for these markets?
So, we are profitable, highly profitable in Korea. Mm-hmm. profitability have been growing dramatically over the last 3 years since we acquired them. We are profitable for many, many years in MENA, in Middle East, mm-hmm. almost every single countries. And when I say almost, it's basically there are three or four that are not. Egypt is one of those. Then you have like Iraq, where we're not profitable today. And that was it, right? Turkey for the last 2 years. But other than that, the other markets are extremely profitable and with a very astonishing cash conversion, which is very important. I mean, this is a cash heavy business once you turn profitable. In Europe, we're not. We bought Glovo, which is reported in Glovo segment, in a European segment. And this is a segment that will still not be profitable this year. But we're on a good trajectory here. And the last one is South America, where we're not profitable. The profitability will be achieved very, very soon.
Okay. And how is the competitor landscape in these markets? Is it that you are dominating these markets?
So, I mean, like there's some slides, if you look at the presentation that we're doing for investors and shareholders, 90% of the GMV that we produce today are produced in countries where we are clear leader. So clear leader means for us, like we are at least three times higher, bigger than the number two.
Wow.
So this is a very distant competitions that we have. I mean, but we do have serious competitors. And this industry is, in my view, remarkable because this is a young industry, if you look at the history of this industry. But the consolidation took place very, very early days. I mean, like 2013, 14, 15, 16. This is where a lot of companies or several companies have been making acquisition, and we're one of those. Today, there are almost no local players. I mean, almost none, or very, very adjacent countries.
Yeah. Now, we just all learned that Uber Eats is now invested in Delivery Hero and also taking over the one of your markets. Can you give us a little bit more insights into this deal?
Yeah, so the deal is quite attractive deal. The valuation is much higher than the current market valuation of the company. There is an upfront payment that they've done. They bought some equity in our company, mm-hmm. a little bit less than 3%. Mm-hmm. And then the deal is now subject to antitrust review. So we think that's going to take 12 to 15 months. And the valuation is around $1 billion.
Wow.
And this is this is for one market. So you can see basically when you look at the valuation of the group today and you sell Taiwan, which is basically, to come to your question of profitability, is break-even-ish. And the valuation from the peer, so basically you can say fair market value, is around $1 billion. So you can see that basically there's a lot of, for the ones that understand the business and can see basically trajectory, there's kind of, this is very attractive business.
Okay.
So I'm fascinated by these, by the scope, geographic scope of your business and by the diversity of it and by the differences. 70 countries. Let me ask two or three questions that are actually, my first question is you're not active in Germany. You exited the market. Yeah. You sold your German business a few years ago, I think, to a Dutch company at the time. Then, 1 or 2 years later, you decided to go back into Germany, only to exit again 6 months later. Why in out, and why being out at the moment in Germany?
Well, we started the whole story of Delivery or Lieferheld started in Berlin, right? So. Mm-hmm. And we've been as I mentioned before, an acquisition, so M&A machine. So we've been buying companies, but we were also selling companies or closing markets. And a lot of people forget about this. So we've been extremely rational the way we've been approaching this industry. And in the market in Germany at that time, so back to 2018, there were mainly two players, us and Lieferando. And the story of Takeaway at that time, which is not just Eat Takeaway, was around two markets. Netherlands and Holland and Deutschland. So for them, it was very difficult to sell one of the two main assets, which was the story, the IPO story. And we basically tried to buy them several times, and we didn't find an agreement, a common ground. And then in December 18, it was very fast. Within 3 weeks, we decide for ourselves that it would be beneficial for the shareholders to sell it. And we sold it for 1.2 billion euros, which was a very, very high valuation at that time. The story continued after that because what we did with these investments, we accelerated our marketing campaign in Korea. And that was driving the motivation basically for Woowa to accept to sell to us. So we realized that the market in Germany will never grow as fast as Korea. And that's what we decided to sell Germany and to to try. I mean, like you don't have a certainty around the success, but to buy Korea.
All right.
And why we entered back Germany is basically, as we took the decision, we were not aware about DoorDash or Uber Eats entering Germany, but we thought that Takeaway or Just Eat Takeaway was very weak in on delivery. And we were looking at Volt penetration in Berlin and in other markets. And we saw that on delivery was after COVID, was basically a market that where the consumers and the customers were starting to appreciate the service and willing to pay for it. And we thought this is now or never. I mean, now is like either we come back or we'll never re-enter Germany. And we tried and we said the investments. And then Uber Eats announced that they will come back and DoorDash. And then we realized, okay, the investments are going to be too high. So rather you take a decision and everyone will think, oh, this is silly and why did they do this? Than to say, no, I continue for the next 2 years and burn cash. And that was the decision. Mm-hmm. Very rational again.
For you, it seems the dominant markets are actually in Asia and Middle East at the moment, at least. You're notably absent in North America. No presence in the US. You're not active in New York or any of the other metropolitan areas. What's the reason there?
Again, it's coming back to the early days. I mean, the main players in the industry were located in Europe or in the US. Grubhub was already with Seamless. Grubhub was buying Seamless, which was a competitor, and were present in the US. But they were little or to non-focus at all in, you know, what you used to call the emerging market. So basically, there were opportunities to buy Maxipiti in Turkey or Talabat in MENA, while no other competitors were really looking at this region at all. And the same happened to South America. So we are able to do two acquisitions in South America and then basically have a footprint on the entire continent. While in the US, we knew, okay, if we want to start a business, we already have a very strong opponent. And then the investments that you would require would be extremely high.
Mm. So looking at your business activities, and you were saying this just a couple of minutes ago, so it looks like you're a deal powerhouse, right? So you are good in executing deals. So my question is, how do you run these deals and how do you prepare it? What makes you so successful in deals?
Well, I think there's two parts, right? There's the negotiation. So basically identifying. The first thing is like strategy. So do we want to go to South America and markets where you already have this industry where people will have the first reaction, why don't you stay in Europe? Why don't you go to North America? Or you go exactly the opposite. You go to other markets where basically we're not on the screen. And that was, MENA was one of those. When you had already a company that was 17 years old or 15 years old, and we were more looking at the delivery culture. So it was more important to us to see where do you have a delivery culture, where people value the delivery. And then, you know, to do the deals is basically to be close to the entrepreneurs. I mean, if you look at the history of Delivery.io, what we did really well is that when we did a deal, the founders, the entrepreneurs stayed for us many, many years. Some of those are still with us. I mean, if I look at Greece, since 2015, they're still with us. Mm-hmm. And that was very important to us because you have a big difference between entrepreneurs and managers.
Yeah.
For us, we saw ourselves as almost a federation of entrepreneurs. And this is how we, so first we approach the entrepreneurs, understand what the appetite, what they want to do, and if they want to build something bigger with us. And then we negotiate. And quite frankly, we're pretty aggressive in the negotiation compared to other players. They were ready to pay more. And then yes, a good M&A is not the contract that you sign, is part of it, but this is integration. So what was required also is like a kind of 100 days integration. What do you do the first 100 days? How do you make sure that you integrate and which part you want to integrate first? Because on one hand, you want to give liberty to the entrepreneurs to continue to build a business. But on the other hand, you have certain requirements, requisite for the capital market, right? So, and this is, I think, what we learn over the time is how to onboard a company without jeopardizing the business itself, while respecting basically the financial market requirements.
So a whole string of these M&A deals happened in the years 14, 15, 16. I think you mentioned that you did, I think when we talked earlier, 17 M&A deals
that's
in
correct.
2 years.
Yeah, that's correct.
So the speed of decision-making was in these days possible because you were still a privately held company. Is that correct to say? Would that not be possible now, you being a public company?
I think it would be almost unrealistic because you will have to onboard a company only for the financial statements. It would be extremely difficult to do like for like and all this kind of exercise. You have to do pro forma like for like and so on and so forth. So I would think it's, I really think it's almost impossible to do it. At that time, we were private, as you said, and then we had investors that were understanding the game pretty decently. So they were supportive and they understood like the consolidation is going to happen now. I mean, if you want to be in these regions, you have to be fast. You have to be fast. You have to acquire. And yes, we were basically in two modes. We were in negotiation in terms of M&A transaction, but also in financing. So we had to do a lot of financing. And this is what we've done. So we were on the financing side, and quite frankly, sometimes we receive the money on Monday and we wired the money on Thursday. So we knew exactly it's just in time.
Interesting. Right? I mean, some of these tickets were really big with three-digit million numbers. My question is, in such a market with such a high dynamism and fluidity, I would call it, how do you do the valuations? I mean, how do you reach consensus on such prices if the markets go massively up and down all the time?
So, I mean, like, it's looking back, right? I mean, at that time, the market were more stable than today in terms of valuation. And we had like already peers, public peers. So we could orientate ourselves on the enterprise value that were basically paid for on the stock, on the financial market. So we had an orientation. And that's basically what we did. We also discounted quite a lot in terms of acquisition. So I would say, especially Niklas Utzberg is pretty known as a good negotiator. I think we've done pretty decent deals. The ones we are surely the most proud of is the acquisition in Korea. I mean, if you get the value of what we paid and compared to what we generate on profit today, it's a very good return.
So how's the deal pipeline for the future looking like now?
That's a good one. I think, to be realistic, I mean, we have 70 countries. We consolidate around most 300 companies. So I think today, and also the appetite of the financial market is much more on efficiency and to be lean. Our footprint is wide enough. So I would say, I would never say never because the industry is changing so dramatically and also the financial market, quite frankly.
Sure.
I mean, so I would say today the focus is much more on consolidation. Consolidation means like looking at the markets where we see a clear path to leadership. I mean, there are still markets where we're not leader and that we will be absolutely rational. We've done this last year in Vietnam and we will continue to do so. I don't see us extending our footprint as I speak today.
So you said, you're generally quite happy with the deal history. At the same time, you know, the last 2 years, you had to write off a good part of the goodwill from these acquisitions, almost $1.9 billion last year, and I think 600 and something in the year before. Is that a reflection of, you know, simply a re-evaluation of the whole market? Is that coming from the interest rate, dynamics? Or would you say it's also a verdict on the deals themselves?
I think this is a combination of the three, to be honest. You have to imagine, like when you do an acquisition, I mean, like, you know, it's based on DCF calculation. So you have a terminal value that is in 10 years in advance. Certain acquisitions we've done before COVID. So you had like a growth rate of 100%. As I told you before, the podcast, we grew by more than 100%, 12 quarters in a row. So like basically
That's almost difficult to imagine.
Hyper growth. Yeah. So when you do a business plan, even if you take a conservative approach, everything below a certain percentage of growth is almost like, but look at the experience that we've done. I mean, like, so you assume certain growth rate before COVID, and then the interest rates, clearly, I mean, the so-called WACC have a massive impact on the valuation. So yes, I mean, the projection is different today. You're probably more conservative. You see also like certain areas like Asia, for example, the segment of Asia is not growing as fast as we thought. The industry have changed dramatically. So the marketing spending is also more rational today with us, but also with the competitors. Which have an impact also on the growth rate. So this is a combination of the and you can assume like at that time, to come to your point before, we use certain valuation that we will not use today. I mean, like we bought certain companies at certain valuation, which has the only way to acquire these companies and was expecting from the seller, but also from us as a buyer. And today this valuation is different.
So this all, as you were saying before, puts a little bit more pressure on profitability. And as you say, it's about consolidation. It's about efficiency. It's about the economies of scale in the operating model. Looking at your business with 70 countries now, what's your outlook on how will you create this profitability, and what are the economies of scale that you see that are available?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like the profitability, believe it or not, I mean, like, we might be startup, but you still look at the profitability from day one.
Yes.
So it's more, I mean, how long will it take, and mm-hmm. and what is the opportunity? I'm also investors in startups. So, and one of the thinking, especially now in 2 years in startup, is like, you will have some CEOs and founders that are so scared that funding round is not possible that they will focus on profitability. And this is a kind of dilemma that you have. It's like, okay, you might be profitable, but if someone else is more aggressive
quicker,
on growth,
faster
and quicker,
yes.
you will be disappear. I mean, like, so this is like the
it's kind of trade-off, as you
exactly.
say. Yeah,
you have a trade-off to make,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, and for us, it was like the profitability was never like maybe one day or yeah. something that is completely out of this world. It was
yes.
much more like, okay, by the moment we see a certain scale,
yeah.
we should turn the unique economics in positive. Today, our core business, I mean, we started with food, is highly profitable.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're building a second industry. And what we do today, I mean, because you ask, like, what is the path to profitability and what can we do? Mm-hmm. We call it the levers.
Yes.
Is basically to generate more revenue out of every single order. And there's still a lot of bandwidth to do that for this industry. I mean, we introduced like 3 years ago a service fee, which is in some countries 20 cent or 30 cent only as a fee, which is nothing compared to the basket size that you get per order. So there's plenty of room to increase
yeah.
the service fee without hurting your growth rate. And there's several ways to do that. And efficiency. I mean, we still have to improve our efficiency in logistics. We are pretty far today, but there are mm-hmm. still ways to improve it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're, if the core, a logistics company,
yep.
probably fair to say, right?
Yes.
Let me come back for one second again to these, to me, fascinating 70 countries in very, very different regions of the world. You're at the same time in the food business and in some way, of course, also, which is very culturally determined, probably with very big differences across the countries. How standardized are you in your technologies, mm-hmm. in the way you do things, deliver your services and you know, steer the company internally? And how differentiated do you need to be to adapt to the differences in the countries?
Yeah, that's a very good one. Because basically at the meta level, this business is always the same. You deliver mm-hmm. pizza, you deliver coffee. But then if you look at the details, every single market will have the specificities. In terms of geographic, in terms of habits, for example, Greece is very particular because 1/3 of the orders is coffee, which is very unique in our portfolio.
Interesting.
Yes, I mean, like, you yeah. see, and then I yeah. can give you, like, for every single country, I can take for hours.
Very special
circumstances. Hours.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
you know, in Hong Kong, we have walkers that are delivering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you see, I mean, like, every single market, we have something specific. Okay. So you have to adapt. At the same time, we do have what we call internally global services, which is very important. The global services are, you can look at kind of modules, technology that we offer to every single country. And logistics is one of those. So if you order today in Taiwan or in Dubai or in Finland or in Chile, the logistics software is exactly the same. So this is the same logistics software that we use for the shift planning, for the calculation of the distance and so on and so forth. So the technology is exactly the same. And we do have a global services that we call global services that are the same everywhere. Where we differentiate ourselves is basically then, well, the product offering on the platform and also like your, well, certain organization of logistic.
Mm. We were talking a moment before the interview and you were saying that, you know, it's so difficult in your business to plan ahead because you don't know where the orders come from at any point in time. So I would imagine that modern technologies, AI-based, you know, predictive, you know, modelings play a role and help you in these, you know, plannings.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, like, I will give you an example to make it tangible for everyone, for the listeners. Every single rider that is online with application, at the moment they start the shift, we will ping in every 3 seconds. So every 3 seconds, We will ping his mobile phone, obviously not to control himself, because I can hear maybe like some term rumors or whatever. No, this is not for that. It's just collecting data points to improve the predictability of logistics. And for that, you use science. You use science, I mean, algorithm, but also science to enrich your algorithm. So we're constantly looking at better optionalities. At the beginning, we were using an algorithm from an American company that is starting with a G, and we recognized that actually R is better. Because okay. we were using the riders that are on the bikes, yeah. on the motorbikes, yeah. and not so generic. So that's yeah. why, you know, we focus on the very specific algorithm. And that makes us actually more predictable, which is very key for the consumer experience. Because today, I mean, it's one thing to wait 30 minutes or 25 or 45. The most important is to be predictable for the consumer. So if I tell you today it's a busy day, there's a game of Germany playing today in Berlin, and the orders you would have to wait, unfortunately, because a lot of people want to eat. You will understand this as long as the prediction time is right. So I tell you today, unfortunately, is not 25, it's 45. Do you still want to order? If you said yes, you want your order to be delivered in 45. That's okay. The contrary is not.
How's the compliance landscape around all of this? Because I mean, as you say, it makes you smarter and the customer appreciates it, but nevertheless, data privacy topics come up, and also compliance in the question on the impact of the rider's law in Spain. So can you give us a little bit of an overview on the compliance and how you deal with it?
So you know, there are different kind of compliance topic that we have to follow. The first one I would say is the food compliance. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that people usually don't really mention, but it's very important because we are responsible as a platform for the menu on the platform. So if you want to order today and you're allergic to onions, you have to know that in this pizza there's onions.
Okay.
And they were responsible for this. So we generate, basically we work with database, and it took us quite some time to rethink the product itself or the platform itself in order to be able to do that. You do have data privacy, obviously, so that we have to follow this. So we collect really only the necessary information from the consumers, which has a price. I mean, like for marketing campaign, you know, you would like to be more precise, to be clustering your customers better. And that is difficult due to the data privacy, which is also like, I was in Brussels lately and we discussed about this, like, you know, are we selling pizzas by the end of the day? So, you know, data privacy, like, you know, but that's another topic. And then there's the riders, right? Yeah. And the riders is a very interesting one. I mentioned before that we are really pro-Europe. I mean, we had the opportunity to be listed in the US, or we thought about this, and we wanted to be listed here in Germany. It was very important to us. If you look at the European Union, we have 27 member states. None of those have the same legislations for the riders.
Oh.
None. Zero. So we do have, and we face everywhere a certain politician pressure.
Yeah.
And we, so far, I mean, Spain is obviously one of the most prominent topic today, but we had situations in Norway, in Sweden, in Finland, in Austria, and everywhere we find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't believe it, but like, for example, in Austria, the exact translation is free employees. So basically, this is a mix of freelancers and employees. And this is Austria, right? So there's a solution in Austria that is really unique.
Yeah.
I would like to have the same for all Europe.
Yeah.
In Norway, we have a bargaining agreement with the largest unions of the country. 50% of their working population is unionized in Norway. Yeah. Also, people don't know this. We find a solution for them. So there's a wish, there's a solution.
We've already been talking quite a bit about the mixture of business model and finance and financial, you know, performance and so on. It seems to be a very intricate mix between, you know, business strategy and steering and so on. How exactly does it work, your cooperation with the CEO and you know, strategy, operations, finance? How far does finance reach into it? You know, what's your remit exactly as the CFO in all of this?
Oh, that's okay. Well, first of all, I like to understand my departments and my teams are enabler. Basically, we are the enabler of the strategy, and the fact that if you want to grow, if you want to do M&A and be public at the same time, you will need enablers to make sure that you can report at the end of the quarter and that you are able to onboard these entities and different topics that these entities will bring with them. So I understand ourselves as enablers and facilitators. With my CEO, I mean, basically we've been working 10 years together. We share the same desk for 10 years. So we are really close together. And we will talk about finance, but also mainly about strategy and what comes next and how should we reconsider our footprint or portfolio. So it's a very interactive combination and cooperation that we have. At the same time, you know, since we are public, we have to fulfill every single requirements like the more classic companies in Germany, like the Siemens, Volkswagen of this world. So there's certain compliance topic that, you know, we still start up in a spirit sometimes, but we have to fulfill exactly the same requirements.
Mm. My, you know, assumption would be that if you look at the current situation and your capital markets combination, it's almost imperative that you show a clear path towards profitability, mm-hmm. right? You're already on that path. Uh-huh. That's what you communicate. You're almost profitable, so to speak, at least in terms of EBITDA and cash flow. Or
yep.
That's the storyline. So what are the main levers, the main dials you as the CFO are looking at and trying to turn a little bit, you know, to the one side where it moves into the direction of profitability?
Yeah. So, yes, you're right. I mean, like last year we were operative cash flow. We were almost break even, coming from very, very negative free cash flow the year before. We improved our EBITDA by more than 700 million last year. The trajectory will continue this year. So I think the company is on the right path. And this is one of their aspect of my decision, as you know. I think what we do is basically to continue to improve our unique economics. And I mentioned just before the levers. You have to imagine if you do 270 million orders, if you are able to increase your service fee by 10 cents per order, it's 27 million EBITDA. That's it, done. I mean, like, you know, and it's 20% and so on and so 20 cents and so on and so forth. So you do have, with this scale and you continue to grow, you have the capacity, once you become profitable, that is amazing. I mean, like, you know, you just have to trigger it a bit, you know, this unique economics. So, and once, you know, the markets or the areas like quick commerce are becoming more profitable, then you can trigger even more profitability. And this is for certain, this is, but that means also like this is very attractive business. So you do have competitors coming in and trying to get a share of the market and so on and so forth. So it's not going to be a walk in the park.
No,
but the trajectory is pretty clear for the last years.
Your EBITDA was, I think, around 250 million.
That's correct. I just EBITDA.
At the same time, the last line of the P&L, yeah, which is net income, was still quite strongly in the red with,
yes,
2.3 billion.
Correct.
So what makes the difference? And you know, is EBITDA, I mean, many companies communicate EBITDA, but you know, what's the meaning of EBITDA and all that? And should, yeah, investors just really focus on EBITDA?
Adjusted EBITDA. Yeah. Adjusted EBITDA. So the adjusted EBITDA that we use
adjusted
today.
Adjusted EBITDA, right?
Adjusted, yeah, EBITDA, yeah. So the adjusted EBITDA that we use today come back to IPO. So this is the definition that we gave at the IPO, and we didn't change it since then, right? The adjusted EBITDA for the listeners is we try to give, or we want to give, a clear understanding of what the operations are generating on EBITDA. Below adjusted EBITDA, you will have different aspects. One of those is related to transactions. So you have to imagine if you do an M&A transactions or financing transactions that is quite sizable, then you will have, I mean, like banks that you have to pay and notaries and fees that you have to pay to the banks for the financing or for the deal itself. And that, in our view, is not related to the operations. You also have share compensation for the employees. But what we had last year, and you mentioned it before, we have impairment. And that was like a vast majority of it. So going forward, if it depends on the interest rates evolution. So like basically all DCF calculation and projection will be impacted by this. I mentioned this before. And now we have like a projection that is more in line with what we've seen over the last 2 years. So I would say at some point the impairment will be gone. And then, you know, like we will continue to grow the adjusted EBITDA. So, I mean, I've been studying in Germany, you know, like Haberstock and Wöhr are the ones that, you know, are important to me. So, you know, exactly. I mean, what counts at the end of the day is how much money you've done. I mean, how much cash. And that's the metrics that we apply also at Delivery Hero.
That surely brings us, Emmanuel, to the role of a CFO,
yep,
to the role of the CFO. within Delivery Hero. So maybe from a broader perspective, what would you say? What is the main, let's say, role of the CFO within Delivery Hero? Are you the critical investor view? Are you the performance manager? So maybe, because you also said you are working so close with the CEO and co-founder, so maybe you can give us a little bit overview on the role.
It's certainly a kind of almost sometimes Kafka situation that you have, right? So on one hand, you present the company to investors that are critical. I mean, like, you know, the last 2 years and asking for profitability and so on and so forth. And internally, you defend exactly this view. So you have to, you know, to explain to the external world, well, but this is what this trajectory and these investments make sense. And I believe that too. And internally, you have to protect basically, or you are the voice of the investors and almost the market. So it's a kind of sometimes funny situation, right? And yes, you're right. I mean, I'm looking at the performance. I would ask like about the return on investments of certain investments that we're going to do, of the trajectory of certain countries or unique economics. And basically looking at the cash flow is like, look, these kind of investments are simply not possible. Or, you know, sometimes I will use what we call internally my veto. It's like, no, we don't do this. Full stop. But I really want to, I mean, this kind of, I don't want to see to be financed be perceived and seen as a blocker, which is, I mean, finance in general, right? So including legal, tax, and everything, but much more an enabler to fight for. Hey, if you want to do this investment, so for example, the Dmarts, as we started the Dmarts, we've been involved from the very beginning, and like, okay, let's set up this entity this way. Let's think about inventories. Let's think about. So it was like from the very early days. We said, hang on, I mean, like, give us some time to really prepare this and not, you know, the startup like I do it and then I fix it.
Yeah. So that sounds like you need a very strong finance function and you need to have a great team. And that also needs to be equipped with, let's say, the tools that help you to steer it that way. Can you talk a little bit about how does the finance function within Delivery Hero looks like from an organization, but also from a technology perspective?
Yeah, happy to. So I will start with the technology, and then so early days we, for the consolidation, one of the difficulty that we had, and I say early days 2013-14, was really to consolidate our numbers. I mean, we were acquiring companies, we were very young companies, and the classic one was like our consolidation was done with Excel packages, with a lot of mistakes, like, you know, like, oh, there's formula mistakes, so you have to change it. So we're looking for a software, and we use the software Lucanet. Still today, we do this. We also like implement very early days for the size of the company at the time. We pick up an ERP solution. So we've done an FP. At the end, we end up with a Suspect 3, like, you know, the Microsoft Dynamics, Oracle, and
typical
SAP.
Yeah.
And then we decide for SAP. And we started the implementation in 2016. So it was very, very early days. And a lot of shareholders and board members were questioning this decision. But first, it was clear, if we don't do it now, it will be extremely difficult to do it like in 2 years or 3 years from now. We're growing so fast. Our systems are not going to, we're going to collapse as an organization and systems. So today, SAP S/4HANA is still our core, FICO, and like, you know, financial controlling. We do have all the sort of modules around it, like Ariba, Concur, you name it. And we're introducing now OneStream for the consolidation. So this is happening as we speak. And ANA plan for planning. So to really standardize, it's a next generation, let's say, for the software, to be efficient, to make the information available for everyone, and also like to use the data for the analysis, correlation, and also, as you mentioned before, AI.
Yeah. And looking at the team, how many people do you have in the finance function and how qualified are they? And how do you organize them in structures, maybe?
We do have four hubs, four regional hubs within the group. So, like, you know, we do have a hubs in Singapore, in Dubai, in LATAM, and in Europe.
Okay.
And then we do have what we call a central organization or central in Berlin. The people in Berlin, I mean, all of them are very specialist. I mean, like, in terms of, we don't have a lot of people, actually. Treasury is very, I mean, like, to give you an example, treasury is only 10 people.
Lean structure for the size.
Very lean structure. Yeah. We use software. The treasury management system is very helping us. We're introducing a lot of automation. So we want to be lean as an organization and use technology. That's really, for us to focus. Automation is also very important to us. And we still have a lot of progress to be done. I mean, like, we don't leverage enough artificial intelligence today.
So, Emmanuel, we've been talking about Delivery Hero and your role as the CFO now for quite some time. And so intimately, almost, it might come as a shock to our listeners, turning to, your decision to leave Delivery Hero. It's a public knowledge, so we can talk about it. I think by October, you will be working somewhere else at another company, Wise, a fintech in Britain, in London.
Yep.
After 10 years, that will be quite, a cut, big decision for you and for the company, a big change. Why? What's going on?
No, I think this is a big change. There's certain goals that I wanted to achieve. And the last one was like, make sure that the company is profitable at adjusted EBITDA level. And also becoming cash flow positive. And this is this is the moment where I said, look, at that time, someone else should come. I strongly believe that after 10 years, there's a kind of risk that you become blind, that you don't see things anymore, you have to reinvent yourself. And I think it's good for the company to start with a new view, let's say. It's not an easy one. You invest a lot of time. 10 years feels much longer at Delivery Hero. Every year you do an MBA almost because there's a lot of new things coming out. But I thought it was it feels like the wise decision. And why joining a fintech is because I believe in the fintech for many years. I think the service there, there's a lot of services that you can provide to the consumers. But for Delivery Hero, I think it's a really good, I really think this is a very good decision that to have a new person coming in, it will give a new impulse and new initiatives.
10 years, yes. 10 years from the early days of Delivery Hero to, relatively, as you say, now reaching profitability and a more stable phase. What's for you maybe the biggest challenge you face and the biggest learning you take away from these 10 years, from this decade?
In terms of success learnings I can also share. Well, success for me was there's literally three. The first one is the Korean transaction. I think in many ways we had the chance to buy the number one. So it was number one by size, but also they built a fantastic company, a fantastic brand. We don't realize in Europe, but in Korea, if you are an IT student, in the United States, you would probably go to Apple, Google, Amazon. Well, in Korea, you go to Naver, Kakao, or Woowa. So this is the three main companies. Cool. So this is a really you buy something that is really unique. Really, really well known, respected, and everything. So, and we bought it for a very good purchase price. So I think that that's one. It requires sometimes to fly to Korea for 11 hours. You land at 11 o'clock. You take a shower. You negotiate for the afternoon, and at midnight you take the flight back. And at the end of the year, when you get this done, you're pretty enough. This one, I really think this is my number one. Number two is something that happened in Saudi that I don't want to give too much details, but that was very important. And number three is the IPO, because it was not expected. Well, my job was to do IPO readiness, but not to do IPO.
So you asked me the successes or the learnings.
Yeah. In the learning.
Let's come back with the learnings.
Yeah, that's right. So the learnings for me is I was always shy to get experts on board sooner. So I was worried about the money. Funding, and I was maybe I can wait a little bit more until I get an expert or someone required, for example, a head of tax. And by the moment you get this kind of experts on board, actually you accelerate you have more resources, you have more energy. And it was it's a learning for me. It's get as a CFO or anything in managers, you just I don't know the word in English, dirigent, you have musicians around you. And your job is just to synchronize them playing, but you should have the best the best instruments you can get, because then the music is clearer. It's easier to do your job, right? And I tend actually to wait too long. I think that was my mistake.
Looking at the experience of the last 10 years and your time before with Videocast, Meta Design. So my question is, if you're looking at the young generation, and we
I'm coming from finance transformation, how we call our consulting business. We have some challenges finding young people. Mm-hmm. It's to attract them for finance. So, but I do believe it's a very, very interesting job because you do the performance management. You are the ones who are, of course, part of the deals. You are the ones who do understand the data and the facts. So what would be an advice, especially from this entrepreneurial spirit you were referring to in the beginning? What would you say? What makes a good CFO in the future? And if you look at the young people, how can we convince them to take a career in finance?
I think what is fascinating in a job as a finance person, and then I will refer probably more to the controlling aspect of finance, is that in order to predict the future, mm-hmm. you have to understand the present and the past.
Very true.
It's like basically you look at the, and there's so many factors today. I mean, like, you know, we talk about crisis, you know, you have to reflect the FX development, the hyperinflation, yeah. the outcome of certain votes, yeah. you know, that will happen yeah. in the US, in Turkey, whatever.
Geopolitical situation and what's the financial impact, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So basically what I like about it is that you have to understand your company very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, to know, you know, like all the balance sheet, the P&L and everything, to understand the trajectory and the present of today
yeah.
and try to, you know, to think about what are the alternatives or the path for the future, and then to give it as clear as possible to the top management to take a decision. And I find it always like amazing. It's yeah. like, wow, to try to predict the future and hopefully to take the right decisions for the company to follow. I mean, you know, like we talked about Germany before, right? I mean, like, so we entered Germany, it was like something like September. And in December, we took the decision to close Germany and to close Japan. But we were like, you know, the market out there is changing.
Mm.
And it was not already, you know, you couldn't perceive on the stock price. Yeah. I mean, we were at 130 yeah. euros stock.
Yeah. yeah.
But then we said, you know what? There's something here. Doesn't feel so good for next year. So let's stop Japan. Let's stop Germany. And yes, people will criticize. And yes, people will tell like how silly you are. You know what? Let's take the decision. And then, you know, February, March happened, 2022. And then, you know, yeah. like, and we were super pleased to have taken the decision at that time. So we, and this is basically filling the pools, talking to investors,
understanding the silent signals.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's, I think that's what is fascinating. And for that, you need a bit of experience. I mean, in order to do that, and when I say experience, like you don't need to be here 40, 50, but you have to stay within the company
yeah.
to see the evolution. I mean, like it's not happening over 1 or 2 years. I mean, unless you have something like magic, but you need to have a little bit of experience to see, you know, how is the industry is evolving and what could be the impact on the company. So I think that's probably one of their advices, like, you know, don't change after 2 or 3 years. Don't be too impatient, but mm-hmm. embrace, you know, like this longevity yeah. in the company.
So your next station I mentioned before is Wise. It's a fintech, you know, different segment in a way, but structurally it has also some similarities to Delivery Hero. It was a startup, is maybe still in some ways a startup, but already quite an established company, more than 10 years old, stock listed, 4,500 people working there. What's the challenge? Why this company, this particular company at this time of your career?
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, like, it's coming back to fintech, right? I mentioned before. So I think like in a fintech world, there's a lot of products, services that you can provide. I think they are still very, very early days in what they offer. The service that they offer is mainly on three pillows. I think there's surely more coming. There's also like in terms of customers growth, I see a lot of potential there. They haven't done M&A so far. So this is maybe where I can also like help. And financing was not really like what they've done. So I see a lot of opportunities where I can bring my experience, but also where I can continue to learn. And basically see what I want. I want to continue to learn. Mm-hmm. I will learn a new culture, a new city, and also a completely new industry for me. I mean, not completely, but a new way of looking at this industry.
Thank you so much, Emmanuel. This
Thank
was absolutely fantastic.
Me.
We need to come to an end. You know, Gori and I, I'm sure we would have more questions, but I think we need to stop here. We don't stop immediately because we still have one question. That's the question we always end with. And that's the question about a recommendation for a book or another podcast or something else that you may want to give to our listeners.
Yeah, there's a small book I'm reading on a regular basis, and you know this for sure, is there 48 rules of power. Yeah. And these are, I'm reading this and it helped me a lot in certain cases. This is always like 2-3 pages with one advice, and I read it on a regular basis because every time you discover something else, even though you know it somehow, and it's sometimes a tough one. I'm like, there are certain aspects of it I don't know if I agree, but basically it's maybe allow you to understand certain partners or certain person that you
how
might
things
face
work,
negotiation.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So this little book is one that I will recommend. Podcast, I don't have a particular one, but I'm listening quite a lot to Simon Sinek.
Okay, interesting.
Well, you listeners also have our podcast to listen to. And I'm immensely grateful. I said at the beginning I was looking forward to this interview, to this session very much, and I enjoyed it greatly. Thank you so much for making time available. Thank you, listeners, for listening in, and we hope to speak to you very soon again.
Thanks, Emmanuel.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for today. Thanks.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.